The Sunstone Theological Society presents Tending the Garden, Mormons and the Environment, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
This session is Tending the Garden, Mormons and the Environment. I'm Mark Thomas. I'm really representing Bill Slaughter, who has set this up. And I have a very good feeling about this session, because this is, as far as I know, the first time that at Sunstone they've had a panel about environmentalism and Mormonism. I, for years, have been wanting to see something like this, and I'm just very excited. And Bill has promised me more and better things. I'm not going to be on the panel next year. More and better things next year. So, or maybe he'll just have a return of the others. But this is going to be a tradition. I'm reminded of the Mormon hymn: "The morning breaks, the shadows flee. Lo, Zion's banner is unfurled. The dawning of a brighter day rises majestic o'er the world." That's the way I think about this. The opportunity to be able to share these two great traditions, environmentalism and Mormonism. And on the panel today, as you can see on your program, we have myself, Mark Thomas, at the top. And somehow I qualified because I wrote an article once on the Book of Mormon. Actually, I'm an environmentalist, and I have been for a number of years. Gibbs Smith. Is he here?
Yeah,
oh, Gibbs. Oh, excuse me. Gibbs. Excuse me. I was thinking of... that's right. Gibbs is... excuse me. Gibbs is the president of the Utah Sierra Club. It's been for what? A year or two now that you've been president?
Three.
Okay. I have not met Gibbs before. I've seen his name quite a bit. He's been active in environmental issues. He has an excellent company, Peregrine Books, in Davis County. It's a small but excellent company, and he publishes some works that are related to environmentalism. As I recall reading, he had on Walden Pond some writings of Thoreau and things like that that were interesting. He didn't ask me to say this, but I would like to pitch this because it's related to environmentalism. I hope the best for his company and his efforts with the Sierra Club. Wolf Barsh is an artist and draft horse farmer from Boulder, Utah. Boulder, Utah is right next to the edge of the world. And it's a fascinating place, one of the most beautiful places that I've ever visited, by the Burr Trail, that's right. And there's also an Anasazi Indian ruin thing nearby. Nick Carling from Delta Airlines, an environmentalist, is on the end. Again, I'm looking forward to hearing each one of these. Let's start from the bottom and go to the top. Nick, can we hear from you first?
Okay, should I just talk from here?
Go ahead. I'm not sure why I'm on the panel either, but you know, I've been looking the last little while. I'm trying to come up with some ideas to speak on. Since it's the first time, it was kind of open-ended, and I had some comments, and then I decided to change a little bit today as I looked at the newspaper and saw that Governor Bangeter was quite upset with Wayne Owens for Owens had indicated that he's willing to put in some legislation to get Utah some more wilderness areas, up to 4 to 5 million acres. And Governor Bangeter is not too psyched on wilderness areas. In fact, he has some fairly harsh things to say about wilderness. And I thought it'd be a good idea in this, you know, in this forum to talk a little bit about wilderness and why the political arm of the state seems to have such a disregard for wilderness. And most of these people are Mormons, and they have a very different idea about wilderness than I do. I guess I'm going to try to give a few ideas of why I think wilderness is important, and also why
some people are fearful of wilderness. Wilderness, first of all, is a political concept that was developed in 1964 under the Wilderness Act. And what it did was Congress was able to create wilderness areas 5,000 acres or larger in the states that wanted them. And these areas are set aside where man is a visitor. Man is not able to come in with his trail bikes, his chainsaws, his Winnebagos, or anything else. They're pristine areas that are set aside for the areas themselves. And I wondered why we have in this state specifically such a negative reaction to wilderness. And I'm not really sure, you know, all of the reasons. One reason, I think, is our view of that comes through the scriptures. The idea that, you know, through the Judeo-Christian concept of man having this creation given to him by God. And, you know, as the Lord says, this is yours, multiply and replenish and subdue the earth. And it's kind of this idea that we have to, and subdue is the term that kind of bothers me, because that has a negative impact. It's kind of a to dominate, to control. And it's so foreign to, say, the Hopi concept of the earth as a nurturing mother, and using the earth as a place to live, and you take things from the earth, but you don't subdue it. You don't do things that will end up hurting that earth. And I think in our tradition, in the Christian culture, it's a little bit different than that. We have been taken outside of nature through the scriptures, or how we perceive the scriptures as being written, and therefore we have this idea that nature's out here to use, and we're over here to use it, and that's the problem, I think, that many of us have. When we're talking about wilderness areas, it's like setting something aside that can't be used, something that has been given us to use. And so there's a political conflict there. My first experience with the term wilderness in the church came, I think, in junior Sunday school, where a junior Sunday school teacher was telling us the story of Moses and leading the children into the land of milk and honey. And on the way, they screwed up and got in trouble with the Lord for building the golden calf. And as their punishment, they were forced to wander for 40 years in the wilderness. And this wilderness was a horrible place. And this was the connotation that came through these primary stories. And if Israel had just behaved, they would have had this life of ease, but instead they were forced to wander in the wilderness. And some of these other connotations came throughout the years. And years later, I've gone back and I've looked at the scriptures again, and I come away with a little bit different idea. Sinai, far from the place of being a horrible wilderness area, was a place where the Lord was able to loosen the cultural bindings that the House of Israel had picked up in urbanized Egypt. And it was in the wilderness that Elijah fled from Jezebel and Ahaz. It was a place where he fled to ask the Lord for death, but instead was given life. And it was in the wilderness where John the Baptist was nurtured, and where he developed his calling to prepare the way for the Savior. And also, one of the best examples I feel about wilderness is from the Savior himself. After his baptism, the Spirit drove him into the wilderness. And it was in the wilderness where he came to a more perfect knowledge of who he was and responsibility that lay before him. And I find it comforting to know that he wasn't driven to his family or his home or to the holy city of Jerusalem or even the temple, but into the wilderness to be alone. And, you know, members of the church, we claim to hold the keys of the restoration of the priesthood and have stewardship over the sacred aspects of this earth. But what of the earth itself? Who shoulders the burdens of the stewardship over God's creations, you know, over the earth itself? What of the air we draw into our lungs and the waters coursing through the streams, lakes and oceans and even our veins? And what of wilderness, the quiet places where I feel God really dwells? Wilderness is part of mankind's holy birthright, and I feel that it's not to be abused, but to what we should protect and nurture, not only for other species who depend on these areas to live in, but for the spirit that dwells there, or spirits that dwell there. I feel that we should save these areas for a sanctuary for ourselves, for times when we might feel the need to flee to the desert, into the wilderness, for whatever reason. And, you know, I ask the question, what do we ask if we destroy this birthright? What's the price that we ask? What's the 30 pieces of silver? A few more blazing lights in Las Vegas or air-conditioned homes? How sophisticated are bonding to this earth? Have we just out distance our feeling from the things of this earth? And the question I will leave you is, what will our children write of us selling their birthright? What will they say in their book of lives of us? Thank you.
Want him to go first?
Okay, we'll change the order here. We'll have Gibb Smith next.
Mark, are we going to talk and have questions and visit back and forth after these presentations?
Yes.
Hello, I'm happy to be here. I'm Gibb Smith. As it's been said, I'm a book publisher. We do basically all types of books for the national market. We don't do LDS books. I am a Mormon. I'm a high priest. I believe I'm the only high priest that's identified in the Utah chapter of the Sierra Club. And I wonder why there aren't more. One thing I'd like to do among this audience, if somebody would volunteer their pad and a pencil. I'd like to pass it around and at least identify everybody that's here. People that are interested in this subject who may be Mormons, I think it would be an important list to have. It's astounding to me, really, that there aren't more Mormons inspired by their own theology taking an active part in the front lines of the environmental movement in this state. There are numerous national parks, much publicly owned land. And here we are. I mean, Mormons control the state. It is embarrassing to me to believe the theology we do and have the environmental movement essentially run by people who are not Mormons, and most of them are from out of state. I'm grateful for these people, but I wonder where the Mormons are. As it's been said, I've been chapter chair of the Utah chapter of the Sierra Club for 3 years, and I was a member like 15 years before that. But it was about the last 5 or 6 years that I decided that I really needed to act in a way of pure public service, which I view this effort as, a way that's not at all connected with my own business or with any possible personal gain, other than to act on something I believe in. I've taught the class in my high priest group, and I've built in environmental polemics into it, but it's been well received. People aren't offended by it, but I wonder why there aren't more Mormons actively involved in this issue. I'd like for you to try to answer that, maybe in the question period, or maybe no. So you see it as a conflict between population and the environment.
Well, the demand on the natural resources, and probably God, the population that we
have. Yeah, I don't think chopping wood is necessarily the answer, but I really would hope we could talk about that in the discussion. So be stimulated by some of these ideas. But let me give my little presentation real quick, and then I'll get over with that. We can do the discussion. I mean, for me, inside of myself, I respond to how I feel. And as a child, I'm sure everybody's the same way. But honestly, I try to look inside myself and see what makes me happy and what makes me not happy. And I try to act accordingly to be happy instead of unhappy. I really like being in the natural world. I love going on hikes. I love going into the wilderness. I love walking in parks. I love walking. That's how I became an environmentalist, just responding to how I honestly feel. That's the root of my environmentalism. It isn't theological. It's very personal feeling. I think physically, we're part of the organic whole, that we came physically from the earth. I think we are related to all of the life on the earth, the plants and the animals and the physical earth. We're part of it. It's the context from which we came, from our nervous system to our physical characteristics. We came from the earth. And I believe that it is really a mistake to destroy the remnant of that ancient mother. In any way, we shouldn't alter it in any way, because I feel like sometime in the future we will need the knowledge that's still there, undisturbed. So that's like a physical reason to me to be an environmentalist. Theologically, I believe that God created the earth, that the idea of stewardship is an important Mormon idea, that we need to manage well. Manage sometimes means leave alone, restrain ourselves from certain parts, and other parts, manage them well for their preservation. Be good stewards. I believe the earth will eventually become the celestial kingdom. I believe that man is tied to the earth in very special ways, that being one of them. I believe that everything in essence is spiritual, that the rocks, the animals, the plants, everything in essence is spirit and will respond to spiritual leadership. Politically and socially, I believe our culture is materialistic. I believe that those values dominate our society. I believe that the industrial expansion, the need for continual economic growth, is a threat to our own well-being. I believe that tract houses and highways covering some of the best land to sustain life is a big mistake. I believe that damming wild rivers in every single case is a big mistake. I believe that cutting the ancient old-growth forest, there's 2% of the trees that were here before Columbus are still with us. And there is tremendous pressure by lumber companies to turn those into lumber. I believe that something that old, they were here before Columbus, just think of that, we need to preserve for a physical link with that ancient past. For that reason, if no other reason. I believe we need the wilderness as a refuge from ourselves and our own culture, the man-made culture. Again, I'm responding to how I feel when I'm there. I feel after camping, say, for a week or 3 or 4 days, sleeping out under the stars, not having a bath, not and drinking from rivers and threatening Giardia. When I come back and have to go back to my bedroom and sleep in a house, I feel diminished. That's honestly how I feel. I feel a certain diminution of my spirit to have to do that. I always feel good to go out again. So I respond to how I honestly feel inside. I believe specifically, I was thinking the other day, what could I say to give specific suggestions? I mean, we have a tremendous Boy Scout program, but as I see it, as I observe it, the militaristic aspects of being a Boy Scout are stressed. The authoritarian leadership, the uniforms, codes of conduct, following the leader, competition for rank and all this kind of stuff. I don't see a stressing in our culture of the naturalistic, natural history opportunities of being a Boy Scout. I mean, maybe knot tying and stuff like that is still going on, but there could be a tremendous sensitivity built into our young men through a desire to indoctrinate these people with an environmental sensitivity, and I don't think we take advantage of that. I see certainly I think the idea of Christian love needs to be extended to the whole earth, not just to other people. We still have a lot to do there, of course. But I think it should be extended to animals, to plants, and to the earth itself, the physical earth. I think our desire to manipulate things and to expand increasingly is a danger to our own well-being. We need to have some forbearance and some humbleness and some desire to respect instead of just overwhelm. Thank you.
What I heard Gibbs Smith say was really a statement of religion. And actually, Mormonism is a religion, but I think of environmentalism as a religion also. It's certainly quasi-religious, because it deals with right and wrong, it deals with values, but its perspective is different. In Mormonism, our main thrust, our main concern is salvation of the individual. When I think of environmentalism, I think the summary and the foundation of that is respect for all life. And when we see those two logics, those two understandings of life, salvation for the individual and respect for all life, when we think about it long enough, they're the same. At least related. Mormonism, I think, will go through a transformation. It's one that will not be easy,
but let me paint a couple of pictures to tell you why it will happen. In tropical rainforests, there are thousands of species yet to be cataloged. We don't know if they have medicinal use, if they can give us food, if they might give us fibers. We don't know. We don't know them. 2/3 to 1/2 of all species live in rainforests. 15% have names. In 1976, Adrian Summers estimated that we were losing 50 acres per minute of tropical rainforest. Today, Paul Ehrlich estimates we're losing 25 acres per minute. In other words, each year we lose a piece of rainforest the size of West Virginia for logging, for homesteading, for farms. That's one picture. Now let me take you to my sacrament meeting last week for another picture. A woman stood up and said, "You know, I was thinking of limiting the size of my family. And people in the church were telling me that I had enough children and it would be, be all right. But then I read in some publications of the church that you shouldn't limit the size of your family, that was wrong. She has 10 children. A wonderful family. I think she loves every one of them. And I remember the time that I was at the state fair with another picture with Carol Frobos and other people, who is on the national level at zero population growth, is here today. We had worked on a pamphlet on Mormon doctrine and zero population growth. I recall, I believe it was with her husband, a man came up and looked at the pamphlet, walked away. He came back later, crumpled it up, and threw it at us. That was a typical reaction to some people. I see, on the other hand, people that I know who have children who are pregnant and wish that they didn't have them, hope for spontaneous abortion because they don't want the child. Children should be born out of love, not necessity. We love children. We want them here. We believe in environmental issues not because we hate the family, but because we're trying to preserve it. And I recall a bumper sticker in St. George, Utah, when they found out years ago that a dam, if they put it in, would annihilate the only location of the Woonfin minnow. They were upset. "You mean you're going to let a little fish stop us from building the dam?" They've since built it with protection for the fish. And the bumper sticker went around, "To hell with the Woonfin minnow." They wanted to kill that fish, obliterate it from it, so it would become extinct. Why, had I lived down there, I would have broadcast nationally that we had a tremendous thing that no one else in the world had. There's the difference. The God of the doctrine of progress is death. So environmentalists see progress in very skeptical terms, and yet I don't think they realize the consequences, as have been brought up, of what they're saying. Yes, we will have to sacrifice. Our standard of living will be lowered. Yes, these will happen, but we want them to happen. I do. The Earth has a carrying capacity, as any finite space does. There are two ways, and history has told us that there are two ways to stabilize the population, and it will stabilize. In a finite, there's only a certain capacity that the Earth can carry, and I think we've probably reached it, and when fossil fuels eliminate, we may be even overpopulated. But you either increase the death rate or lower the birth rate. Now, if you increase the death rate, that's the way of nature. That's the way that we learned from biology. That's the way we learned from science. That's the way of cruel survival. Starvation. Remember Easter Island? Remember, you can think of many examples throughout history when the carrying capacity was exceeded. War, famine, disease, that's the way of survival. The religious way, the way of God, the way of religion, is to decrease the birth rate. That's the humane way. Now, you have one of two choices. What are you going to choose? I suggest that Mormonism choose its own way. its own way is the religious way, the way of humanity, the way of God. And it will someday. I have no doubt about that. I'm proud to be a Mormon. And I'm proud what the church has taught me. And I'm proud of the knowledge that I have that someday Mormons will recognize the carrying capacity of the earth and realize that the way of salvation is the way of respect for all life.
I think I changed my whole idea of what I'm going to say when I listen to these three, because it seems that I'm coming from a totally different point of view. Well, I'm supposedly an artist, and I'm supposedly farm with draft horses, and I think the idea that I farm with draft horses instead of tractors was the attraction of getting me here to this panel. But there's very specific reasons for it, and sitting here I was getting real antsy about certain problems, that we talk about certain problems where we definitely have the answers. And the answers are so clear that it doesn't make any sense to even talk about the problem anymore to me. Doctrine and Covenant says that this world has enough and to spare, and that by no means can we ever overpopulate. Now, if it says that, then we believe that. It's simple. But see, the solution does not lie in finding solutions how we think of them, but how the Lord has told us. Now, today, Joseph Smith gave us the exact amount of land that a man needs to live on, to sustain itself and all this kind of stuff. Now let me give you a couple of premises and you can check them out. I didn't bring any quotes because I didn't think I would be talking about this. But Zion is an agricultural society. That's a fact. Each family in the church in Zion, once you will live in Zion, you will live on 21 1/4 acres. Meaning you have 1 1/4 acres around your house in which you use for beautification and good living, gentle living, and this kind of stuff. And you use 20 acres in which you will farm to sustain your livelihood. In other words, they figure, and Joseph Smith said, that will sustain any size of family. Now, that's a fact. You can take the Amish, for instance, today, and most Amish farms are under 60 acres. A lot of them are under 20 acres, and they sustain 1 to 2 families and do a good living. Now you say, we can't all be farmers. That's the first answer we get. We live in a different society. We can't be farmers. But see, this is the wrong thing. We live in the wrong world, and we ought to do that which we are commanded. And one of the commandments is to take care of the earth, to take good care of it, and to live up to the standards of Zion, which in turn then makes us take care of these kind of things. Now, and if you take the agricultural land we have in America and divide it by 20 acres per family, you will find out you end up with something like 2 billion people could live in America and sustain themselves well. That's what Orson Pratt did, and he's a better mathematician than I was. Or I am. But that's an interesting thing. See, today it takes over 200 acres to sustain a family. Something like this. And I don't have the exact figures, but you can check that all out. Now you will say, well, I don't want to go out there and be a farmer. But see, you see the farmer as what farmers are taught today. You see these guys on their big air-conditioned tractors in the morning and night working all this, and that's all nonsense. That's the picture of the world, and this is not what it's supposed to be like. Not at all. See, Brigham always said, we all work too much, and we do this too much and that, and he said, you know, we all should work less and wear less, that we can all improve ourselves better. Now, we all know farmers are dumb, and they can't do anything else. That's why they're farmers, and that's why they have to work 24 hours a day, and they never make ends meet, and all that kind of stuff. Well, this is not how it was intended. I really don't think there's any conflict in seeing the proper way of farming and seeing religion, how we're supposed to take care of the earth. But the things that I think we need to realize is that there's different, what you would call them, areas that are designated. Some are designated for people to live in. Some are designated for wild animals to live in. Some are designated to be areas in which you go for retreats, or like deserts and all this kind of stuff. And the term desert is a very interesting one in our religion. But I'm speaking strictly now of, and if you look at the plans that Joseph Smith drew up and Brigham Young drew up of what Zion looks like, you'll find these areas. You'll find that each area that is inhabited by people, the small cities of Zion, will then have wilderness areas around them, have areas for wild animals, areas in which you travel through to see certain things and to learn certain things. But I'm speaking now strictly about the land on which we ought to live, the agricultural land, the land to sustain yourself. Agricultural, in the religion way, was never designed to make a living off of. In other words, to make money off. Run so many 100,000 acres to make yourself rich. It was designed to sustain life. And the interesting thing is that there's practically nobody in the Mormon Church that had ever written about it, except maybe Joseph and Brigham, and maybe President Joseph F. Smith. But since then, we have taken it different. See, Joseph F. Smith said emphatically, if you really want to be a doctor, or if you really want to be a lawyer, or if you really want to be a businessman, don't forget that your first call is to take care of the earth, to be a farmer. Do that in the morning, and then do your business in the afternoon. Because if you really, really want to do that, but that's secondary. The first part, the first commandment given to anyone, is always to take care of the earth first. It was given to Adam down the line, all the way to Joseph Smith. I should have brought those things, but Joseph asked what would be most worth to him, and he gave him three things to do: to take care of the earth, to take care of the land, to sustain the church, and to study and to learn. It's a very short section, I think it's 27 or 29 or something. But again, it's the commandment to take care of the earth. Why is that so? What's so important about it? Why not go out and have a good time? And you can now answer that. But I had a friend of ours visiting the other day, and we were talking a little bit, and he said, I cannot see how people can't see this. He says, you know, all farming today is done by big tractors, and they're very expensive, and they're very destructive. You know, once you start farming with a tractor, every so many years, you have to go to a bigger tractor, because it does something that they call a plow bottom, and you get into this real terrible kind of system. And he said, you know, people look at a tractor and consider it the epitome of sophistication. You know, four-wheel drive and this and this and this, and air conditioning and radios and whatnot. And you can do all these wonderful things, and you can run through 200 acres in one day, and you can have a wonderful time. And he says, and they look at a horse as something that's really rather archaic. You know, it's way back when they used horses, when people just didn't know any better. They were really rather dumb. And so they used horses because they couldn't make tractors in those days. Well, so we talked about it for a while, and I thought, you know, if I would compare myself to a robot, I would consider myself far superior to anybody making any kind of robot. I mean, the most sophisticated robot you can think. Now you compare that with the tractor and horse. The horse was given as the most sophisticated draft animal for farm use. And the tractor is the cheap modern copy. We're trying to get closer to that. And you will say, well, that's really oversimplification. We know we as humans are far superior than anything else, and there's no machine that can even come close to what we can do. And I agree with that. But it's exactly the same on the other side too. The horse is such a sophisticated thing that no machine even will come close to it. Now, I know this sounds funny to you and really rather strange, but do you know that, say, a good farmer in a religious point of view, and most Amish farmers go that way, can make a good living off of 40 acres. And I mean a good living. With raising their children the way they want to, keeping the world at bay they want to, and having money to spare. If anybody gets in trouble, they have money to spare. They don't need insurances. They don't need all these different things because they can do it. Now, have you ever asked a modern-day farmer of how many acres he needs to sustain a family of, say, two, while the Amish sustain a family of 10, you'll come up with the average answer of 600 acres. That's 40 to 600. Now, the price of farmland is the same, around roughly $1,500 an acre. And so there are certain things that are really rather interesting, just on mathematical play. And the thing that I think that I want to emphasize the last, is that we have, and our prophet has said that first, made a wonderful statement. When he wasn't prophet, he said, get big or get out, to the farmers. The big farmers are the best farmers. The big tractors are the best tractors. We now know that that wasn't so. That was a big mistake. And a couple of years ago, Wendell Berry came to visit us, and I took him over to Brother Nibley. And they were really interested in each other. And the first thing that Wendell Berry said to Brother Nibley was, what do you think about get big or get out? He never said hi or hello or anything. The first thing he said, what do you think about get big or get out? And he says, oh, that's nothing. Let me tell you a few good ones. And that's the proper answer. You know, we always get lured away by the world and thinking that's the right way to go. And so we go down this way and go down this way until we realize we've blown it and start over. And so I think the answer really lies in that kind of living. Let me read you a quote of Brigham Young. The religion of Jesus Christ is a matter-of-fact religion, and it takes hold of everyday duties and realities of life. In the mind of God, there is no such thing as dividing spiritual from the temporal or temporal from the spiritual, for they are one in the Lord. Sin consists in doing wrong when we know and can do better, and it will be punished with just retribution in the due time of the Lord. This is the idea. Sin consists in doing wrong when we know and can do better. It's not just breaking a commandment. You know, I mean, there's people that are dumb enough to break commandments that are easy enough, like, say, breaking the Sabbath day or something like this, because it's absolutely unnecessary. But sin consists not only in that, and these are the easy things, those are the laws. That sin consists when you know you ought to do better. This is the idea. Sin consists in doing wrong when we know and can do better. It's not just breaking a commandment. You know, I mean, there's people that are dumb enough to break commandments that are easy enough, like, say, breaking the Sabbath day or something like this, because it's absolutely unnecessary. But sin consists not only in that, and these are the easy things, those are the laws. That sin consists when you know you ought to do better, and you know you can do better, but then shrug it off and say, well, everybody else does it that way, and I live in the real world. But that isn't the real world. See, we live today in the telestial world, and I think it's a very interesting thing that we actually live with television and telephone and all these things that relate to the telestial world. Well, we ought to at least live in the terrestrial world that have things relating to the earth. Terra. You know, tele can mean star, but it can also mean far away. And the telestial kingdom and television is as far away as the celestial kingdom as you can get. And they came to the conclusion that the only economy that ever will work is what they call the kingdom of God. And he isn't a Mormon.
Does somebody have the time? I haven't got a watch.
About 10 to 12.
So we've got 10 minutes?
No, we've got 40 minutes.
Oh, okay. Let's have questions. Yes, in the back.
There was a reference earlier about why Mormons are not involved with environmental issues here. And every reference I've heard to environmentalism in terms of the dirty word here in Utah. Every editorial, environmentalists are comparable to communists and child molesters. I'm curious to know if anyone has done any research as to why that is so. Is it because of the conservative influence that well, government shouldn't decide environmental issues, and it should be a private factor, and Mormons do want to get involved, but they don't want the government to do it, or is it because of the James Watt mentality that Second Coming is here in 10 years, let's use it up before he gets here, right? Is anyone doing research as to the history of the legislative process here in Utah, and also, you know, how the church or Mormons have been involved in that? What is the motivation behind it? Why is it that Mormons don't get involved?
Why don't Mormons get involved in the environmental process? Did you want to respond to that?
Let them respond.
Okay, who wants to respond to that?
Let's let this lady. She has an idea.
Asking the same question.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and tell us your idea?
Well, my response is, we live outside of Utah, and I'm always utterly disappointed when I come back to Utah to see the exploitation of the environment here. The recreational vehicles, the building, the attitudes of people. I'm not sure what the answer is. We're very involved in the peace movement. We're very involved in Central America. And I don't see Mormons involved in even those things which are pretty fundamental to the gospel, as far as I'm concerned. Certainly preservation of the environment is fundamental to the gospel. I think, and there's so much apathy that I see in the church that it really concerns me about social issues, about all of these things. I think it's probably a combination of conditioning for 5 or 6 generations that you fit into the mold, that you don't make waves, that you accept that somehow that's going to be disobedient if you do. And it's produced an apathy that just alarms me and disappoints me of what happens. And I think it's a conditioning that we've all grown up with if we come up through the Mormon culture, here in Utah particularly. And I think it's very sad. I think it's very, very sad. But I think that it's just something that people now are starting to recognize and trying to break out of. But I think it's going to take a lot to do it because you have some cultural conservative leaders who keep reinforcing the conflict that this is going to get us built on what's gospel. But I think we're so concerned about what others think and so concerned about the cultural pressure here that we lose sight of what the gospel is and get those two really mixed up.
Do you think it's a social reason?
Did you want to comment on that?
Yes. Just a few weeks ago, Joe Cannon, who has bought out the Geneva plant in Norm, stood up in his sacrament meeting and said that God had helped him open the Geneva steel plant, and that it was God's will that he do this, and that he was blessed by God. And that, I think that kind of ties in here too, that we kind of see this money-making ethic in Mormonism perpetuates too, and that it's this real individualistic thing that as long as I'm making money and as long as I'm ahead of the next guy, this is God's helping me to do this. And sad.
Yes, behind her, yes.
I have a question when you started your comment. Do Mormons any less concerned with environmental issues than non-Mormon community?
Okay, are we any worse or better than anybody else? Yes, in the back.
I'd like to address that and a couple other issues. I live in Oregon, which is a slightly different attitude than here, but I also worked in Utah for a while. In fact, here some years I worked with Luke and there's a couple of points. One of them, I think, another aspect of it too is this frontier ethic, which is really big here. If you're in the West to conquer, our duty is to go out and just take over and just remake the landscape. There's a real attitude that I think comes through this pioneer ethic. And that's one of the things I used to run into a lot. It's interesting that the verse that keeps showing up in Genesis on multiplying and replenishing the earth, which, by the way, may be the only commandment they ever kept. the word for replenish in the Hebrew to subdue doesn't translate directly to subdue. It's more like tend, as you would tend to garden or take care of. If you want to use the original Hebrew, what it says is we should replenish, take care of the earth, and tend it like you would a garden.
is a place to live, which is an entirely different concept than subdued. Another point, which I was mentioned earlier, but is the problem of development versus the protection of the environment. I get much involved in that. I lived in the Middle East for 4 years, and I'm working part of the time in India now on some environmental research. There it becomes realistic because you have a much different kind of population than we do here. But I also find in many of those countries much greater concern for the environment because they feel a much more of a kinship than we do in the U.S. In many cases, you can develop projects, you can do development and still protect the environment. The old growth issue is another one I'm very involved in right now. There are ways to use forests and still preserve the genetic capability. You mentioned the loop in the dam. The final design on that was modified considerably from what it was originally to try and provide protection, and those kinds of changes can be built in. It's not that there are real problems in doing these things. It's the attitude that you have, the attitude at which people approach us, and they approach us saying, how can we balance if you can make the adaptations and the technologies there? But the attitude is, we've got to go out and develop at all costs, and we've been up to nothing.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I'd like to comment on that, and I think Wolf has really touched on the heart of this, that we have lost a sense of the holy in most of our lives. For most of us, this chair, this table, this microphone have no religious significance. The world around us is dead and inert. Unfortunately, that's a fairly recent, or fortunately, that's fairly recent. I think that maybe since the time of the Reformation, that's been a popular belief. You look in the Bible, even in the Book of Mormon, there's a concept of holy land. The land is holy. Today, it's inert. It's something you manipulate. So I think we've lost that idea of that life has a sense of holiness, that all life has a sense of holiness, that the world is a place of mystery that we don't understand and need to respect. And even when we take a life, even when we, yes, dig a pit and dig a mine, we do it with a sense of awe. We do it with a sense of reverence, like maybe some of the Bushmen, when they kill a deer, they apologize first, realize, yes, we must do this. Yes, I need to live, I need to make a living, and yet, so that our sense of business has a sense of proportion. Yes?
I've got one comment to you. My only thing is that we've got to do something about the environment or we're going to annihilate everybody. But I think in this point in time, we need examples. We need a hero to show us how it can be done. And we don't have that. We have a lot of environmentalists, and thank goodness they do alert us to the environment, and it's appreciated. But what you do, you come, you talk about it, you go out, you get your car, you drive away, you go home to a house, you spend again. You are no different than anyone else is doing. Now, I feel if you really want to get into this, like we all should down the road, if we're going to be annihilated, that we should be examples. And incidentally, Jerome did a better job of supporting people on his Walden Pond. But I'm just saying, we need role models. We need examples. It's hard for us people who are not as knowledgeable in these areas and so forth. We need to have you show us how it can be done. How can we do this? We're at a crossroads as far as humanity is concerned. How many of you up here have a car? How many of you drive car? How many eat your house with gas? I mean, I'm asking you these questions because it isn't going to be done by us saying, oh, we've got to do something, but we never do anything about it. And I just say, right now, we need role models. How can this be done? We talk about it, we discuss it, and we say all these things. We shouldn't be running through or we shouldn't be doing this, but we have no role models.
Excellent point.
Good ideas. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Now, Nick, you had a comment.
Yeah, I think that there are role models. I think we live in a very complex
still a very complex world. It would be nice if we could all go back to the hunter-gatherer type of society, such as the Bushmen or something like that. That is debatable. Okay. The point is mankind existed like that for thousands of years. We're a technological society. We're an urban society. More people live in cities than on farms. And that's basically through development and everything else. Anyway, what we have to do, I believe, is sit down and look at individual problems and say, okay, obviously we can't all of a sudden give up. I guess we could without, but it would cause it'd be basically what happened in Cambodia, where you had the Khmer Rouge come in and move everybody out into the agricultural, out of the cities, become an agricultural society. Forget about, we wouldn't have to kill everybody off like they were trying to do, but trying to put everybody in an agricultural setting would be devastating. That's an impossibility. But it's an impossibility to continue going on the way we've been going without the effects. The effects of the ozone, greenhouse effect, these things are going to keep escalating until there's a serious problem. Those things have to be done on a worldwide thing. I'm not real optimistic about that. I don't see us changing civilization, but I think that we can work on individual issues, such as wilderness, for example. It's just a teeny pocket somewhere in Utah or Arizona or New Mexico. It's a very small pocket that we can deal with. I think there are individuals that really put their necks on the line. Guys like the Sea Shepherd, some of these Earth First individuals that say, no more compromise. We have to make a stand, and we're willing to get arrested. We're willing to be killed for it. Because we can't go on the way we've been going. And as far as protection of other species, the Sea Shepherd going into Iceland and blowing up whaling ships. People are doing things, and other people say, well, that's, you should work within the law. But certain people are they see no results working within the law, and they're willing to be arrested, thrown in jail for something they believe. I'm not saying that we should do that unless you feel strongly about it and are willing to take the consequences. I think there are things to do, and many of them are not very easy. And I think there are things we can do within our own lives. I think the government can do things such as building cars that get pretty good gas mileage. Instead of going back to gas guzzlers because we have cheaper oil now. There's many things we can do, and I just don't see the resolve politically to do them.
Now let me just make a comment. I happen to have just moved to a bank that I'm pretty proud of up in Seattle, and I just am surprised at the kinds of things, Daisy, that they do, and they're successful. They're the largest bank in the Northwest, but... So it's not that they're floundering, and they're successful and they do environmental things. They have a recycling program. Every time somebody uses a piece of paper, they have a thing to put it in to recycle. They have all sorts of programs like that they subsidize busing so people don't have to take cars. They have all sorts of interesting environmental programs. These are from the most conservative element in society. Here we see bankers, So I think it is possible, and I think you're right. We do need people. We do need people in the business community to say, yes, this is a correct point, and I think we will see that.
Just now I was reading about commercials are now into social issues that sell, but they still are sort of waging into those areas.
Yeah, commercials. People believe that people buy their product if they show an environmental stance, and I believe that's true.
There's even some investment fees now. They won't invest in polluting or war type things, and they are successful.
Yes. Yes, here on the second row. Yes.
I'm not afraid of this. We do have role models. Wolf Barsh is one. We don't need any more. We've been given instructions. It just comes down to individual choice. Do we have the industry to do what we have to do? One of those friends is very serious about the things Wolf Force is doing, though he's never heard the name. And I admire people like that who make the individual choices, who have the fortitude to do something that they do feel they care about. It's so impressive.
Yes.
I can say something about it. You know, it's really interesting to me. I'm probably a person of very simple faith. And I believe when the Lord says something that I can take his word for it. I really do not believe that the world's problems are ours. They're his. You have a specific job, and see, we're supposed to come out of the world and do that which he has commanded us to do. And if we do that, we solve our problem, and then in turn, the world's problems will be solved. I cannot solve everybody else's problems if I don't solve mine first. And mine is understanding the gospel and living in obedience to those commandments first. And it's really not that difficult. The role models, see, they're not necessarily in the place in which you would think you find them. The role models are not in the world. And if a bank does all these wonderful things, that's nice because it's a trend or something that might be successful. We'll try this now for a while, and then we'll try that for a while. And if it's successful, even if it seems, you know, controversial, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. See, the gospel gave us already the exact guidelines. Now you say, can you really do it? Do you know anybody that won't go out there and pick up their car and drive home and use gas and turn on the air conditioning and all this kind of stuff? There's plenty of them. I'm not saying that I don't do that, but see, you won't find these people necessarily in Sunstone Symposiums or something like this, because they're mostly not very verbal. But they're trying to do that which is right on that very small individual basis. And only on that basis can you start. You know, saving wilderness is like putting out fires, and that's a good thing to do. But there must be more than that, than just trying to keep things from being destroyed. See, to take good care of something, to be a steward over it, is to build up that the earth when you leave is better than you when you came, not just preserved of what you handed them. You know, the putting out of fires becomes of extreme importance today. But I think as Mormons, there's a lot of people out there that are trying to do that, and we can support them in that. But we have a lot better job to do than just putting out the fires, because we're supposed to understand what it means to multiply the earth, to make it a better place. See, this idea is we're supposed to have this a garden.
Yes, in the back.
It's important not to see the issue of one extreme over another. I don't think Wolf is expounding that everyone should be a draft horse farmer any more than somebody else is, you know, saying that, well, we need to have many babies and not there, etc., etc. It's not a matter of managing the amount of resources we have. Because I believe what Wolf said, we do have enough. God did not blow it, not put enough oil and coal in the earth for us. He planned the earth, and it is full, and there is enough for everybody to go around. The important thing is not that we learn how to manage it. In fact, the important thing is to learn how to change our lifestyle so we don't abuse, which is what we're doing. And I think that's what Wolf is trying to say, is that we are using too much. We are doing a lot of things we don't need to do. There's nothing wrong with driving a car. There is something wrong with driving a car too much, or having too many cars, or using gas like a car. It's a matter of moderation and learning how to change our lifestyles in a way that we are fulfilling God's commandments and not abusing what we've been given. And that is the main issue. You don't need Las Vegas. it's Las Vegas and things like that, is using up those, all those resources that are cutting us short.
Eliminate the obvious problems, you're saying. Yeah, good point. Yes, the middle here.
I think something to come out of all this, that I think it's important for us all to recognize that there are some basic ways in which Mormon doctrine, not only Mormon doctrine, but Christian doctrine in general, there are basic ways that those kind of principles are interpreted that fundamentally disempower us to deal with environmental issues. One of them we mentioned, I think, is the way we interpret the God's commandment in the Garden of Eden for man to own the earth. And that kind of language has come up here in the symposium. You talk about our wilderness, our garden. It's not ours. It's here for us to use, of course, and we have the ability to exploit it, but it's not ours to own and do all that, and that's already been brought up. I think another thing, we have this view that there's going to be an apocalyptic second coming, and it's imminent. We don't need to worry because the earth is going to be resurrected. And that kind of language hasn't come up here today, but it's come up in a lot of other contexts. I think another thing that's really been apparent here is that we tend to look for all the answers and all the interpretations of world problems in the context of our own finite view. We're not willing to step out of the context of what we call Mormonism and see what other people have to give us to further enrich our knowledge base, to further empower us to deal with the problems of our world. And as long as we do that, I think, you know, we tend to set ourselves away and say, philosophies of the world, they're going to deceive you. And we tend to classify a lot of people in that category that could really give us a lot of help in solving our problems. And so, you know, there's just a lot of things like that. We could probably go on all day with things like that. And it's probably not inherent within the doctrine, but it's certainly inherent in the way that people interpret a lot of that doctrine today. I think that's probably the most fundamental problem today, is the way we think of it.
Yes, Ron.
Just to mention a couple of real success stories. Germany, virtually every small town has a living forest. And what they call a living forest is really a forest. It's not like they call it the streets of a living forest. But they really, these are all synthetic, man-made forests with wild boars and deer. And they're within walking distance of the cities, the towns. And they think that urban forest is a very significant element in every community. And they've done that for centuries. And that's where they cut their wood to build their cabinets. And they have the oak right there. And Europe generally, the success of the agriculture in Europe sustained the cities. Okay? So Paris only could sustain a certain population because they had been very successful only in the 50s. Well, we don't, in this country, we don't worry about our countryside and what the farmers can do to sustain the solid city. We buy all our food in California, basically. And when we start thinking in terms of the way Europeans have done it for years, we all like it so traditionally, it's not going to get it. But in fact, it's a very good answer that the country shop side should basically be the city. Okay, that was just one example. The other one is Davis, California. The faculty at the university sort of took over the local government. And they changed all the planning. And they narrowed the streets, and they required street planning on the streets, so they couldn't have too much asphalt, so the city wouldn't overheat it just because it turns into gigantic solar collectors. It's all paved. And it's a marvelous place. And there are more bicycles than cars.
And I thought, gosh, I wish we could do that here. But you know, the hill would kill everybody off. But they won't. Because the new technology is dumb mountain bikes, and you can walk off a wall.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of possibilities there. And we'd be a lot healthier. We'd be as healthy as those little students. They'd pump along with big, heavy bikes. And that's correct. At any rate, those are some successes.
Okay.
Just a question. There was an article in two months ago in Harper's that was talking about the synthetic landscape, that the rebuilding of the landscape, and that that's a very legitimate position to take, and we shouldn't be ashamed of managing new landscape. And maybe if we're creating new landscape, we wouldn't have to protect the old as much because we're going in a different direction.
Yeah, we've built cities based on the automobile and cheap gas. In 40 years from now, we won't have that. But let's have a comment.
I've got a couple of ideas dealing with the basic question of how come Mormons aren't more involved, basically your question. I agree with this gentleman who's leaving that really it is an individual thing. We have to have the courage of our convictions. We have to simply put our bodies in the way and make them be dealt with. I think in a Mormon context, if you're asked to give a talk at sacrament meeting, give one on this subject. Nobody does. If you're the Boy Scout master or you know one, which everybody does, talk to him and tell him you don't want your kids trained to be a paramilitaristic guy. You want him to be trained as a naturalist. Go talk to him if you're a parent. If you live in a congressional district someplace, and everybody does, go talk to the congressman and tell him environmental issues are important to you. I think the Sierra Club basically elected Wayne Owens. We worked our butts off for Wayne Owens, and he's delivering. I mean, Salt Lake District has basically an environmentalist congressman. I think it can happen in other places. But you've got to put your voice on the line. You've got to stand up in public meetings. You've got to go talk to your bishop and tell him you want to talk at sacrament meeting, and you've got a subject you want to talk about. I mean, Mormons don't need to be sheep. The general authorities need to be asked. You could write them a letter and say, write to Neil Maxwell, who's a smart guy, and say you'd like somebody to help work out how Mormons deal with the environmental issues. If everybody in this room wrote to him, I bet he'd consider it. I mean, why don't we do something? Instead of just say, well, we need some role model, or we need somebody to do it for us, or we need somebody to show us how, because it's not going to happen unless we do it.
But, you finished it.
I'll come back.
Excellent. That's good. Good thoughts. I like that. Bud,
I like it, too. You know, I have a rule on the other side of the situation. Now, I think one of the things in the church... And in America, you know, it's this freedom of choice. This is what we're all talking about. But you know, it takes all of us with the freedom of choice as well. Now we're talking about the wilderness. It seems to me that there's a point of view that wilderness can be a multiple use sort of thing. In other words, we have our practical, you know, reality. We have to face with the very fact of what economically we're up against. And to me, shouldn't make Utah a great big wilderness area. Make it a place where we, like you say, the bank is going to take care of and make sure that their wilderness or environmental conscience and the oil companies are extremely environmental conscience, and anyone who has anything to do with the land are environmental conscious. And this environmental movement has done a wonderful thing. It's made us environmental conscious. We still have our freedom of choice. You see, it isn't anybody's exclusive land out there. I mean, unless it's the Lord's. But So it's a matter of discussion and working out what is the best. Nobody has the exclusive power over that land, you know. But we have to recognize what each one of us can contribute to, each one of us' point of view, it seems to me.
Thank you. Okay, Tom.
One of the other things it seems to me that we can do is to create and use a usable past with regard to the environmental successes we have had here in Utah.
A historian speaking.
Yeah,
yes.
The only thing that I heard in that connection was the Wounded Fin Memo, but I don't know how many of you realize that along the Wasatch Front here, 50 years ago, we used to have annual rock mud floods coming down here. We were successful in dealing with that problem. Salt Lake Valley, the air pollution around the turn of the 20th century was a lot worse than it is currently, and we were successful in dealing with that problem. It seems to me that if we understand that in the past we have dealt with some of these problems, we can build on that, use those as examples of the ways that the community was able to marshal its resources to deal with those difficulties, to show that that can be done to deal with problems today. It's not all that we don't have a past in which we've dealt with environmental problems. It's just that the people who wouldn't like to deal with those problems, who are in favor of development, have been the ones who've captured the press with regard to the thing, without recognizing that we have had some successes in the past that we can point to and say, okay, we can do the same kind of thing with these things today.
Yeah, good point. And that would give us a sense of perspective on where we need to go. Yes, here.
I'm going to turn on my rocks before I bet my profession of industrial chemist. I think there are a couple of things that we've got to work on in terms of public opinion. The first one we mentioned back here is pioneer ethics. We've got to work with downplay that in our culture. I know it's fine to revere your pioneer ancestors, but just because they were pioneers, not in and of itself. And we've got to bring downplay also in a sense, I think, that environmentalism and elitism sort of go hand in hand. Environmental concern is sort of the luxury of a developed nation, a country that is struggling just to put food on the table for a population, has difficulty worrying about next year or the year after or the next generation. The big thing, I think, is we have to bring on the true cost of things. Just because the air can be blown through a heat exchanger for the cost of pumping it, doesn't mean that that's the only cost of using that air. You've got to be aware of the fact that you've got the cost and the responsibility of removing whatever gunk you put in so that you turn it back in reasonably decent condition. And the disposable dishes that you use every day, their cost is not just what you pay for in your store, but the little increment of natural resources that went down the toilet with that disposable dish. Those things we've got to be aware of, and we've got to propaganda, I guess.
You've
got to make that message, get the message across.
Yes, in the back.
I might mention, if none of you have ever read Garrett Hartman's essay on the tragedy of the commons, I would strongly encourage you to do so. His comments fit very good too. But two points I want to make. One of them, we've talked about Mormon theology on the environment. There's a principle called the Gate Principle, which fits very nicely with Mormonism and make an excellent basis for a theoretical strong Mormon movement. The second thing, there is our organizations around. There's one called the Global Tomorrow Coalition, which has over 200 U.S. organizations, membership in about 50 other countries. Most of these are not government organizations, they're what they're called non-government. They cooperate in exchanging information, ideas, success stories, and the like. They have old periodic sessions where you can come, and they're group sessions, much like this, where they have presentations and discussions. But one of the key points they make, in fact, their motto is to think globally and act locally. In most cases, it's hard to influence what's going on in another country, but you can locally, and the way to do it is just what you said, and that is to go to meetings, review environmental statements, as boring as they are, and I've written through myself, but actually participate. I work for the federal government, and I see a lot of this process taking place in some places like Utah where issues come up. There's almost no comments from the non-users. If you have, say, some mining situations, they put out plans to review, almost no comments come in from people who you would call environmentalists. It's almost always on the other side. You have to get involved. One advantage of Eugene, the Forest Service recently came out with a timber plan for one of the national forests. They had over 90,000 comments from both sides of the issues. And those things do influence the people. And you don't have to be an expert. If you have an opinion, an idea, go say it. And I like the idea of, I have a friend who is a good environmentalist who has made talks at church and stuff. He said it's almost like some of them had a vision. They had never thought of these things. It's not so much that they're against the ideas, is that it just never occurred to them. And once they begin to see, I think you can make a lot of environmentalists.
I think we could make a culture. A culture in Utah that would be the opposite of how it's been described, simply by emphasizing through doable ways in our Mormon context, we could change it.
I believe that will happen. I really believe that in Utah will someday become an environmental center. You started it in a symposium, Bill.
I might mention there's at least three general authorities who have made some very strong environmental statements in the public forum, which is kind of interesting. I think there is.
Ron,
who are they?
But to do that, any way to get there, we've got to stop thinking that the gospel is true and capitalism is true and the Republican Party is true. So we're going to start thinking about, and I didn't mean to knock Republicans, but I don't know that political parties get very much done per se. I mean, they do, but they respond. They're responding. They're not creative.
Yeah.
But until we stop doing it and think about what we share in common, and it's our public standard of living that counts and not our private standard of living. Because the socialist countries are nothing but space. They have an incredible standard of living that we don't even begin to understand.
Yeah, Germans have a steady state economy right now. It's tremendous. They don't want it to grow. They're happy.
best example in the world is people living in the garden.
So how can we change it to the Mormon opportunity we have? How can we turn it around?
Can we start out as a humanitarian? John's crazy for this. We start out as a humanitarian society, and we've gone against that. I don't know.
I would say each one of us ought to make a resolve today to do something. Join some organization, speak to somebody, examine your life. Yeah, do something. We can't do everything, but do something.
That's why I wanted to get this list of people here. I think that if we have that list, there are some people who would like to see a Mormon environmental network, at least, the people that are connected.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone touched on this, but it's just Americans, we're just really materialistic people. We're comparing to European things. I think European culture might be materialistic in the sense that they like fine things maybe more than we are materialistic in wanting more and more and more and more. And until you change it's hard to change the hearts and the minds of people. I'm materialistic. I think everyone has the potential to be. Some people are more than others, but I think that's probably the thing that's the biggest roadblock.
But see, there is nothing about our Mormon culture that is against an environmentalist point of view or against developing an environmental culture. All it requires, as this gentleman said, is waking people up, and then they say, yeah, I guess that's right.
People's values are materialism.
Yeah. John.
Well, I have just two general comments. The first comment is that, like any social movement, I'm gathering from listening to four of you that representatives. You've all used the term environmentalist to describe yourself. Mm-hmm. I think environmentalism is a pretty broad movement. There are many. Well, you may not. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think someone can be an environmentalist and, like, someone can be a Christian or whatever, and have a different
point of view from someone else who uses that term. The important thing that is that, for me at least, to see that there are some ways that environmentalism can fit into my worldview, and my worldview can fit into it. I may not go to the point where I'm willing to blow up ships in Greenland. I may or I may not, but there is a place to which I can go. Whatever place I can go, that's going to be the best. And corollary to that is the view that somehow environmental activities are not necessarily against us. Now, if I never go to a wilderness area, which I probably won't, if I never go to a wilderness area, like my friend Nick in Utah, so what? What am I going to lose if there is a wilderness area? See, we get in the idea we are... The lines become hardened that somehow if we're going to have a wilderness area, that that's a direct threat to our livelihood. Somehow it's going to hurt us. It isn't. It isn't, whether we use it or not.
We're battling about ideas.
Yeah. Let's mellow out a little bit.
We've got to close now. Let me just end by saying one thing. There's a parable of Jesus I like a lot that you remind me of, and because I feel that same way. It's a simple parable. A man throws a seed out, and by some miracle, the seed grows into a plant and grows corn. I don't know how.